Today is Burks against Ramish. Mr. Dodd.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, this appeal concerns whether the District Court erred by dismissing Mr. Burks' amended complaint for failure to state a claim. When the facts are construed in the light most favorable to Mr. Burks, and when inferences are drawn in his favor as they must, it becomes clear that it is not beyond a doubt that Mr. Burks can prove no set of facts consistent with his allegations that would entitle him to relief against defendants Shakur and Salinas. Therefore, it was an error by the District Court to dismiss his complaint. Beginning first with Defendant Shakur, she was the health services manager at the Milwaukee Secure Detention Facility, the MSDF. In January 2007, Mr. Burks filed a grievance with Ms. Salinas. In response to that grievance, Ms. Salinas actually contacted Ms. Shakur and then later issued a report that instructed Ms. Shakur to follow up on the medically required treatment for Mr. Burks. As of January 23, 2007, when Mr. Burks was transferred to the Dodge Correctional Facility 19 days later, Mr. Burks still had not received the medical treatment that Ms. Shakur had been instructed to follow up on. The fact that she did not follow up as instructed can support a claim for deliberate indifference. And it's clear from the cases, too, that delay, not just the outright complete denial, but delay in treatment of medical care can support a claim of deliberate indifference. With respect to Defendant Salinas, it's a bit more complicated, and it deals not with the January 4th grievance, but the earlier grievance, which was filed on November 8th. On November 8th, Mr. Burks filed a grievance after having submitted two requests to the Health Services Unit for medical treatment. Ms. Salinas rejected that request, and she basically rejected it for a procedural requirement. The grievance itself does not appear in the record. We only recently obtained the grievance itself. So in making his ruling below, the district judge basically drew the inference from the rejection, which said the inmate complained about medical issues from September 12, 2005. The grievance itself actually complained about medical treatment over the entire period from September 12, 2005 until November 8, 2006, the date on which he filed the grievance. So it was error to conclude.
I'm puzzled by the idea that people who handle grievances can be substantively liable. And suppose you have a claim and the grievance examiner, whoever is responsible for handling grievances, says this is untimely. You have to file your complaints within 30 days in this prison. You've waited longer than that. Your complaint is rejected as untimely. Could that be a source of liability under 1983?
I believe, depending on what the grievance itself says, the answer to that question is yes. And even in its ruling, the grievance...
The underlying proposition seems to be that not only the grievance examiner should ignore the state's rules, although we keep saying they're supposed to follow the state's rules on timeliness and other issues, but also that everybody in the government who learns about somebody else's misconduct has a duty to act, and if he doesn't act, he's liable as if he were committing the misconduct himself. And, of course, we've got a lot of cases that say that's not true. If one policeman sees another policeman make an unlawful arrest, he does not, for example, have a constitutional duty to intervene and block the first policeman from making the arrest. I don't see why things would be different with complaint examiners in prisons.
Well, the complaint examiner in prison, you're dealing with an inmate who cannot receive medical treatment on his own, and you're dealing with a person who has been charged with hearing whether there is a complaint, basically responding to a grievance, and where the grievance itself puts the complaint examiner on notice that I am being deprived medically for my serious medical needs, the duty arises. And I think that...
But you say that, but what is the basis of this duty? I've given you the example of the policeman. The Supreme Court holds in Monell that there is no vicarious liability under 1983. The proposition that anybody who learns about something must fix it requires justification, and I'm wondering what justification there is.
I believe, as cited in the brief, the cases of Greeno v. Daly, Johnson v. Doherty, where they talk about a complaint examiner who becomes aware.
Yes. The question, that issue was not briefed in those cases. It's one reason why we issued an order directing it to be briefed in this case. And if you have some reasons, either some decisions of the Supreme Court or some reason, this is your crack.
I'm sorry. I think I'm not understanding the question from the court then. If the question is from where
does
the duty arise?
Come from that any state actor who learns that there is an allegation that some other state actor has violated the Constitution must do something about it. Right? If I learn because somebody has filed a brief in the Seventh Circuit that in some state prison a doctor is not very good and is not adequately providing medical care, do I have a duty subject to a lawsuit if I fail to go and clamor with the state of Illinois to hire better doctors?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that the duty is grounded in the Eighth Amendment, and I don't think it's necessarily that the complaint examiner is learning that some other state actor has necessarily is not performing their duty. The state actor or the complaint examiner can learn of the need for required medical treatment, and that can be separate from whether it's actually someone is directly responsible for depriving it.
You're just repeating the assertion that any state actor who learns that another state actor isn't doing his job is liable unless he does the job instead.
No, I'm sorry, but that's not what I'm trying to say. If the state actor learns that the inmate is not receiving adequate medical care, whether that is because of the function of another state actor or not, perhaps the inmate failed to file the health service request procedure in the first instance.
There's nothing in this about inmates. The Constitution's got a lot of requirements. This may have to do with welfare. Think of the welfare bureaucracy. Caseworker illegally denies welfare benefits to Smith, and there's an appeal within the bureaucracy. Jones learns that caseworker may have done this, but Jones doesn't fix it. Is Jones liable? One has to start this inquiry with the assumption that the lowest level within the bureaucracy has done something wrong. And then we're trying to figure out whether some higher level within the bureaucracy has a duty, subject to personal liability if he fails, to see to it that the lower level guy fixes the problem. That's the question I'm asking. And it's not limited to prisons, not limited to the Eighth Amendment.
Okay. Well, I apologize because the facts in this case arose in prisons. The briefing was done under the guise of the Eighth Amendment.
The problem is general.
And I understand the question that the court is presenting, and at the moment I cannot tell you where the duty would arise under the facts that the court has presented to me.
Others, right? There are a lot of allegations in Chicago that police officers have beaten prisoners. And people complain about that there's a review board in the police department about that, right? If you're right about the complaint examiner here, anybody in the police review board who doesn't ensure that the cop is fired is personally liable, and so on.
I understand. If there are no further questions at this time, I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Dodd. Ms. Gibson.
Good morning, Your Honors. This appeal is about a four-month period of incarceration at what's essentially a jail. And during that period, Mr. Brooks was seen on four occasions for long-term eye condition, according to his own assertions, that dated back over a year prior to this period of short period of confinement. This appeal does not concern an acute eye injury. It does not concern a failure to continue treatment that was begun on the outside and interrupted by incarceration, and does not concern a failure to a refusal to examine Mr. Brooks. The attachments to the complaint refute all those types of claims. The district court properly screened the amended complaint and concluded that it failed to state a claim against any of the defendants, including the two defendants Mr. Brooks continues to pursue through this appeal, Kelly Salinas and Aisha Shakur. Regarding Ms. Shakur, who, as counsel said, was the health services unit manager at the Milwaukee facility, the amended complaint failed to state any allege any personal involvement by her. Instead, Mr. Burks asserted in his amended complaint that by virtue of her position, essentially, Ms. Shakur must have known about his history of treatment. Personal involvement, however, is precisely what is required to state a claim under Section 1983. Liability does not attach merely by virtue of one's employment position. Today, Mr. Burks' counsel tells us that Ms. Shakur committed a constitutional violation in January 2007 when she was notified by the inmate complaint examiner that Burks was scheduled to be seen by an optometrist, which it turns out he already had been seen by an optometrist, but they didn't know that, and that she should follow up. But according to Burks' own assertions, he was seen by an eye doctor at Dodge Correctional Institution, another DOC facility, on January 25th, 2007. That's in the record at 856. Unless Mr. Burks is asserting a claim that he had a constitutional entitlement to have his long-term eye condition seen within a period of less than 3 weeks or less than 2 weeks, there's no claim at all against Ms. Shakur. Regarding Ms. Salinas, who was an inmate complaint examiner for the Department of Corrections, Mr. Burks' only assertion against her is that on November 9, 2006, she erred when she concluded that his inmate complaint concerns events that happened 14 months earlier, events far too old to be grieved, rather than inferring that his complaint asserted an ongoing health need. Burks argues that this, her understanding of his complaint amounts to a constitutional violation on the premise.
What comment do you have on the question I was asking of Mr. Dodd? That's the main reason why this case is here, why counsel was recruited, why we're hearing oral argument.
Well, I have to say, Your Honor, that I understood, and I'm pinch-hitting today. I didn't write the brief myself, but I understood the court's question in your order to ask whether inmate complaint examiners have a legal obligation to make sure an inmate's complaints are resolved. And I thought the verb resolve was particularly unfelicitous in the inmate context because it invites any inmate who's unsatisfied with his medical care generally to say, yes, I got treatment, but in my own mind, it wasn't resolved. I think today you're asking a somewhat broader question, which is when governmental officials who are made privy or put on notice that another government tall official has erred themselves have a constitutional obligation to an affirmative duty essentially to either fix it or have committed a constitutional violation. Now, because I misunderstood your question, I didn't research that question. I'm unaware of any case law that would support imposing such an affirmative duty on governmental officials. In the brief, we argued that Salinas's mistake didn't amount to constitutional violation for three reasons, which I think are separate from the question you're raising today. The first being that her description of his claim was that it was, quote, about medical issues from 9-12-05. She just didn't understand that he was asserting an ongoing problem rather than a complaint about the past, and thus would lack the subjective knowledge she would need for deliberate indifference, even assuming it's a legally available remedy here. Second, to the extent Burke is suggesting that her response was ingenuous, that she was just trying to kick his claim, even though she knew he felt that he was in dire need of medical care. Then you go to her January 2007 response to his second inmate complaint, where she conscientiously and very thoroughly goes through his whole medical history, looks to make sure that any medical care he was receiving on the outside has been followed up on. She sees that he wasn't receiving medical care on the outside. And then when she thinks erroneously that he has not seen an optometrist, she orders that done. In fact, at the end of the day, he sees an eye doctor, according to his own assertions. So at most what you would have...
Why are both of you interested in whether this happened at the end of the day? Isn't it equally good if they see the eye doctor at 3 p.m. rather than 5 p.m.?
Sure. But I think Mr. Burks would...
But both of you asserted that they saw the eye doctor, quote, at the end of the day, and I just can't see what constitutional bearing that has.
Well, it's the third time that the phrase "the end of the day" has been used this morning, as far as I'm counting. So maybe we're just echoing each other thoughtlessly. But at most, Ms. Salinas's error was an isolated incident of deliberate indifference, and it's established law that such an isolated incident—an isolated incident of carelessness, which would not amount to deliberate indifference. And finally, Burks fails to show any connectedness between Salinas's misunderstanding of his first inmate complaint and a lack of medical attention. As I said before, he was seen four times during his time of confinement that we know about from documents he's filed with the court. Finally, Burks tells us that the real complaint is not that he wasn't seen at all, but that the treatment took place at too slow a pace. The pace of his treatment, however, was a medical determination. No one determined that Burks needed any surgery, much less immediate surgery, for a very long-term eye condition. And a delay in treatment can constitute deliberate indifference, but only where immediacy is medically required and recognized as such. And in Duncan, the case cited in Burks' reply brief is a great counterexample where the inmate had a diagnosed bone fracture. Everyone agreed it needed surgical treatment and that he was in extreme pain, but for various reasons it was delayed for 22 months. Here, in contrast, Burks was diagnosed with no condition warranting any surgery, much less surgery that needed to be performed immediately. There was no objective or subjective knowledge of a need for treatment that then was delayed during the four-month stay at the jail. Because the screening in the case was proper, the state defendants asked that the district court's screening order be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gibson. Anything further, Mr. Dodd?
Yes, just a couple points, if I may, Your Honor. First of all, I would say that I do agree with counsel for appellees. I also did understand the question from the court to be in the context of complaint examiners. I didn't see the broader question that was posed here today. If you would like further briefing on that, of course, I'm happy to do so. Just with respect to a couple things that was said by counsel, Mr. Burks did allege that he suffered an acute eye injury. The paper submitted with his complaint showed that he had a pinhole in his eye and that he was being treated on the outside at St. Luke's Eye Physicians Hospital. It's also clear that Defendant Shakur, had personal involvement in the fact that she was directly instructed to follow up on his required eye treatment, and she did not do so. In terms of the characterization that no one determined that Burks needed surgery, he never was seen by the eye specialist who would have been able to make that determination. On November 10th of 2006, it was determined he needed to see an eye specialist. He never, in fact, saw the eye specialist, even though he was at MSDF for several months thereafter. And if there are no further questions, I will conclude. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. And Mr. Dodd, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case. And the assistance you've been to the court as well as to your client. The case is taken under advisement.